Hello, Ramblers and Gamblers. Josh Rosenthal here. Thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing IG at Rambling and Gambling. And please shoot over an email anytime you want. RamblingandGamblingPodcast@gmail.com. Today we are talking about good news for the Commanders. You don't hear that much. Also other NFL odds and ends. Some really good stuff with Pro Football Focus's Eric Eager. Then we've got VSiN's Ben Fox coming on to tell us exactly what happened with NBA draft betting markets. That's an interesting one too. And I heard from a ton of listeners on that one. So I wanted to do kind of a quick breakdown of it today. And lastly, NBA free agency starts this week. So I invited our buddy Fred Siegel to come back. Fred runs the absolutely awesome Freezing Cold Takes Twitter feed. He's got a book coming out too. I asked Fred if he could give us his three all-time favorite NBA free agency freezing cold takes. And so that's coming up at the end of the pod. Pretty good ones. Fred unearthed some gems for us. Anyway, let's get things started with Eric Eager. Eric, great to have you, buddy. I tell you, we have talked a lot on this pod about not the best Commanders news, the alleged misconduct, the investigations from the NFL, Congress, FTC, attorney generals in multiple jurisdictions. Right now, depending on who you talk to, Dan Snyder may or may not be fighting a congressional subpoena. So when I saw your article showing that you were pretty bullish on the Commanders this season, I was like, oh my gosh, as a long-suffering Commanders fan, I need to get Eric on the podcast. And then turns out our timing is pretty good too, because we are recording this around 5 p.m. Tuesday afternoon. Just in the past couple hours, it breaks that stud wide receiver Scary Terry has signed an extension with the Commanders. This is all very good news, Eric. And it's a little bit of a different, it's a change of pace for us Commanders fans.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, it's hard to divorce, you know, what the franchise is doing versus, you know, what it is on the field. I've been back and forth on the Commanders, up and down. Like I had a season win total over five, in 2020, just because I thought that defense could be scary. And I, you know, and rest in peace, you know, I thought Dwayne Haskins at least had a chance to be kind of a competent quarterback. And ultimately, like, that win total went over. They went 7-9. They won a division. And then last season, I was kind of bearish on the team just because I thought that there were so many, sort of weak links on the team. And, you know, whether that be, you know, the COVID stuff, the quarterback stuff, I thought that a win total of 8.5 was way too heavy. And now, you know, I sort of think the pendulum has swung back. I think folks are, you know, I think when you look at that offense, Terry McLaurin's fantastic. I think Josh Doctson's a tremendous draft pick. I think when you look at the defensive side of the ball, there are a lot of really good players on the defensive line. There are some players in the secondary that could have bounce back years and be useful for that team. And then you look at the quarterback, and I think the quarterback has a chance to be a better player than people are handicapping him at, and especially be a better player than what the Commanders dealt with last year with Taylor Heinicke.
Okay, so let's dig in a little deeper. First of all, I'll set this up just by saying that right now the Commanders' season win total over under most places it's either 7.5 or 8. I actually, preparing for this, you've already convinced me, Eric. I took it last night on Caesars. I took the over 7.5 at -115. I should say you are a data guy. Your arguments are built on data. It's not silly square betting fans like myself who end up taking the over every year, you know, no matter what. And you break down this argument in a lot of really good ways. You've already kind of mentioned some of them. Let's dig a little deeper. One, I thought this was interesting. You said that last season, offensive coordinator Scott Turner actually had a pretty good year. You liked a lot of his play calling. However, you didn't like the play of Heinicke, as you mentioned. And also, this may surprise some fans, Antonio Gibson, right?
Yeah, and Gibson was an interesting one because I think a lot of people remember the end of the 2020 season. They look at that Thanksgiving Day game in Dallas and how well he played. And, you know, they thought about, you know, his career at Memphis and how explosive he was. And I think there's always like a little bit of a bias towards wide receiver type players who play running back. So everybody liked Antonio Gibson. And if you looked at sort of like the, you know, volume stats for him, you know, they were quite good. I mean, he, you know, the standard, and I know the standard is different now because we play, with 17 game season or whatever, but, you know, he got over 1,000 yards. Yeah. He had, you know, multiple touchdowns, you know, he had double digit touchdowns, I believe, if you include pass receptions. The problem was, is, you know, he had a really good, set of opportunities for him to have that success. I mean, their team, I believe, is second in the NFL behind Kansas City in plays that we call perfectly blocked, meaning that, like, when our graders at PFF said, you know, no player in this chain link of players made a blocking error. So left tackle to right tackle, there's a tight end, or there's a fullback or something like that. None of those players made an error. You know, league average is somewhere around 35%. Washington was about 42% of their plays were perfectly blocked. The problem was Antonio Gibson had one of the worst yards per carry averages on plays that were perfectly blocked. It was under 5 yards per rush attempt. And there are running backs in the league that get 5 yards per rush attempt independent of how, you know, whether the play was blocked well or not. And so I get nervous if I'm a, you know, I get nervous, I think, if I'm a Washington Commanders fan, because, you know, I just don't necessarily know if he could hold up. And maybe he was injured last year, but I think if he's injured last year, what you really want to do is find out, you know, whether, you know, really early in the season, whether or not he can give you what you need, because, you know, for that offense to hum, you know, we saw it with Wentz last year in Indianapolis. For that offense to hum, they do need a good running game.
It's not going to surprise anybody that you think Terry McLaurin is a very, very good wide receiver, especially when you consider who's been throwing to him his entire career. What may surprise some people, still pulling from your column, is that you think the overall Commanders receivers group this season could be among the best in football.
Yes, I think, you know, when I look at, you know, and I'm a Kansas City fan, like they picked 29th and 30th. And if you ask the Chiefs front office, there was a message from me to them, like basically every day in March and April, asking them to draft Jahan Dotson. And ultimately, Washington, after trading back out of 11, end up taking him, you know, 13 spots before the Chiefs ever even had a chance at him. And I just really am a huge fan. I think, you know, you look at McLaurin, he's a guy who gets open. He's a guy that tracks deep balls really well. He's a guy that's good play after the catch. And I think Dotson has all of those traits as well. He was like in the 95th percentile of players we've graded in terms of getting open against single coverage. But he's also somebody, you think about Penn State, they had guys like Sean Clifford playing quarterback, and he was still able to track deep balls. He was still able to make plays. He was super productive in an offense that didn't really, you know, have great quarterback play. And, you know, we can say what we want about Carson Wentz, but, you know, he's going to be okay. Like Michael Pittman emerged under him last year. He's going to be a competent NFL quarterback. He's not going to be great. He's not going to be a Super Bowl guy, but he's a guy that's at least going to get you on the green. And I think that'll highlight how great McLaurin and Dotson are. But then you go even further down the list. Logan Thomas is a pretty good tight end. Ricky Seals-Jones, had some moments last year. And then you looked at Amy Brown out of North Carolina. I think was a fine prospect as a 3 or 4. And then obviously Curtis Samuel coming over from Carolina, I think is a much better wide receiver than people give him credit for, and much more than like the kind of gadgety guy that I think a lot of people, when they think about Curtis Samuel, you know, think about in their intuition.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but your pro Carson Wentz take essentially boils down to, hey, he's better than anybody else the Commanders have had since Kirk Cousins, maybe Alex Smith.
I mean, Kirk Cousins ultimately was probably the best quarterback Washington's had, you know, for more than 1 year. I think the RG3 year was probably the best for a long time, right? You're going back to like Brad Johnson, maybe. I don't know. Like, it's been a while since they had like truly good quarterback play there. You know, he also has gone to Minnesota, he's only been in the playoffs once, you know. So it's sort of really tough to find a franchise quarterback and to find one that's good enough to pay a lot of money to. And so I give a lot of credit to Washington, you know, going back. So they went, you know, in and went all in on RG3. That didn't work. Then they go in and trade Kendall Fuller in a third round pick for Alex Smith. Alex Smith won 11 of the 16 starts he had in Washington, but obviously that injury, hurt him there. They try Haskins, that doesn't work. They try Fitzpatrick, that doesn't work. But they're never bad enough, in most cases to get a draft pick high enough to take one of these truly top guys, right? Even in the year they got Haskins at 15th overall. So they go ahead and go with Wentz. Wentz had more big time plays and turnover worthy throws last year. I think if you polled people in Indianapolis and asked them how many more touchdowns than interceptions Carson Wentz had, I don't think the average person would say 20, but he did have 27 touchdowns and 7 interceptions. He's played in the NFL for 5 years, 6 years, and 4 of them he's had exactly 7 interceptions. So I think even his turnover worthiness is a little bit overblown. He's a big guy. He runs okay. I don't think he's the long-term answer, but I think insofar to get you to 8 wins, 9 wins this year, I think he's perfectly acceptable.
Last point I want to pull from your column, and this is what really put me over the top and had me betting the over here. The defense. You're right. This is a quote. The group went from facing one of the easiest slates of opposing quarterbacks in 2020 to a much harder group in 2021, but they returned to more of an easier slate in 2022 and will face the 4th easiest schedule in the league. That's pretty big.
Yeah, and that was the thesis for last year, right? You look at the 2020 season, and I want to say, it was they beat Wentz, they beat Hurts, they beat DiNucci and Andy Dalton in Dallas, they beat Nick Mullins with San Francisco. They did, then I want to say they beat Big Ben, who, as we all know, is over the hill. And all the quarterbacks they beat were kind of atrocious. You flip over to last year and you're going Herbert, Mahomes, Derek Carr, Tom Brady, who they ended up beating, over and over and over again. I think Aaron Rodgers was on the schedule as well. And it was just going to be murderer's row. And then this year now they have the 4th easiest schedule in the NFL. They do get Dak Prescott. That offense, was really good against Washington, especially in the second game last year. But it's had its ups and downs. You obviously get Daniel Jones and New York Giants again. You get Jalen Hurts, who, could go either way. I think the Philadelphia teams can be okay, but, that's not a guarantee. So you get a much easier schedule. And, this is a defense. Look, Chase Young hasn't lived up to being the number 2 overall pick, but he's a pretty good prospect, right? You look at Jerome Payne. You look at, the folks up front, Jonathan Allen and so on, that's a pretty good defensive line. We talk about perfectly blocked runs, against Washington last year, only one team surrendered fewer as a percentage of the plays perfectly blocked runs on that side of the ball. So they could stop the run. They could rush the passer. Kendall Fuller was somebody 3rd in the NFL last year, 14 pass breakups. So they had some of the goods. William Jackson is one of those players that every 3rd year he's amazing, and every other year he's kind of not so great. Cameron Curl, there's players on this team that I think can really make a defense, not necessarily be the reason they win, but not be one of the reasons they lose like they were last year.
I want to hit some other random NFL stuff with you, but real quick, how would you recommend listeners bet this? Because there is some nuance here. I talked about how I have over 7.5 -115 at Caesars. You can get 8 in some places. I believe you can also get 8.5 +145 if you bet the over in other spots. How would you recommend listeners go about this?
7.5 -115 is the best number you're going to get. That was a very good one. 8.5 +145 is plus EV, but obviously they need to win 9 games. Now you get a bigger payout for it. Those are two, every bet, is basically just as good. You have to sort of think about what the juice is, but 7.5 -115 is the best expected value of those two bets. From there, you can bet a bunch of alts. But to me, I think this division is such that if you're thinking about, let's say you wanted to bet them, over 8.5 +145, or let's say over 9.5 at 2-1 or something like that. Just bet them to win the division, or bet them to go to the playoffs. I think going to the playoffs is something I saw at one book at +170. Because this is an NFC where they might not necessarily go over 8.5 wins, but they might make the playoffs at 8-9, right? Just like they did a couple years ago. They might win the division with 9 wins. And you're getting a much better payoff at 9 wins at a division winner if you bet them to win the division than you would be over 9.5 wins type of thing. So I would, if I were betting sort of more of the longer shot markets, I would bet them, I would bet into how weak the NFC and possibly the NFC East is, which is, you know, Washington to win the NFC East, Washington to make the playoffs, more than I would bet them any like more alt overs than like, I would say like 7.5 is a good number. You're not laying that much, but you're getting, you know, a pretty decent payout if you win. Plus 8.5 is fine. But like the further you get on, I don't see Washington being a 14 win team, but I do see them possibly being like a 9 win team that wins the NFC East because every other team has a season like they did a couple years ago.
All right, random NFL. Let's see if we can move through these kind of quickly, Eric. I know it's hard. You've written full columns about all this stuff, and I'm asking you to give me like 30 seconds. But anyway, here you go. First up, you are relatively high on the Lions this year and relatively low on the Dolphins. How come?
Well, the Lions, to me, well, it's all about schedule. The Lions have, you know, a top five easiest schedule in the league. They played extremely hard for Dan Campbell last year. People, you know, they scored the most points in the NFL in games that where they had 1% win probability or less. So that team didn't quit. I think they tanked last year, but they tanked by not putting talent on the field. They didn't tank when, after they got between the white lines. So I think Dan Campbell is a good guy that can motivate them. You look offensive line, 3 first-round picks. You look at skill position players. You have Chark. You have Jameson Williams. You have TJ Hockenson. DeAndre Swift. Amon-Ra St. Brown. Like, I think that there's talent there. And then on defense, you have Aiden Hutchinson. You have, you know, Jeff Okuda hasn't played all that well yet, but we know that corners take a while to sort of play well in the NFL. You have Amani Awuwarie, who had 6 interceptions last year, who can play, you know, decent football. And then I think their coaching staff, like I said, I think gets them on the green. Their win total is only 6.5. So I think it's 6.5 now. So the bar is pretty low. And they're a team, they don't go west of the central time zone. They don't play a game after 1 Eastern all year. Like I said, easy schedule. Bears aren't very good. The Packers aren't as good as they used to be. And the Vikings aren't as good as they used to be. So I just think it's a schedule play. And that's kind of where I flip on the Miami Dolphins. And I say, well, their schedule is a little harder than normal. AFC's tough. And then the question becomes, like, you add a lot of weapons there. But Tua's got to play well. And, you know, Tua last season had just 10 what we call big-time throws. He had 22 turnover-worthy plays. He was a much worse player than, let's say, Carson Wentz even was. And if you put Carson Wentz on that Dolphins team, is anybody all that – like, and their win total is 9. So you put Carson Wentz on that team and say, hey, you got to get over 9 wins. I think a lot of people would bristle at that. But that's essentially what the Dolphins are doing, except with a worse quarterback than Wentz in Tua.
You shocked me in a column that you had a week or two ago. You wrote about the NFL's best offensive play callers, and you had Kellen Moore of the Cowboys ranked number 2. That's ahead of guys like Sean McVay, who was 5 on your list, Kyle Shanahan, who was 4, and just for the listeners, Andy Reid was 1, Byron Leftwich was 3, but you had Kellen Moore at number 2. What's that about?
Well, I just look at the Dallas Cowboys and I, you know, there's extremely good production there. And, you know, we're not necessarily, you know, I don't necessarily know if we're discussing, like, you know, sort of what is the engine that sort of makes that offense work. So, you know, I think of this, like, so in their first 6 games last year, they had 451 yards, 419 yards, 380 yards in a blowout where they scored 41 points and kind of took their feet off the gas. 433 yards, 515 yards, and then against New England, they had 567 yards in an overtime win. They have their bye week. Dak Prescott comes out, can't play because of a calf muscle, and they go to Minnesota and beat the Vikings with Cooper Rush at quarterback in a game where they, you know, gained 419 yards of offense. You know, that's pretty impressive to me, and a lot of people will say, okay, that was because of, you know, offensive line play. Well, their offensive line was banged up last year. Or they'll say, oh, this is because of Zeke. Well, I think most people that have followed Zeke know that he's a declining player. Amari Cooper was a declining player that they ended up only got a 5th-round pick in a trade for. I think CeeDee Lamb is a great player, but they lost Michael Gallup to injury. And in the second half of the year, they were still relatively productive, despite the fact that Dak Prescott wasn't sort of himself because of injury and so on. I'm going to attribute some of that to Kellen Moore. They were first in points scored last year. They were third in yards per attempt. They're a top 10 team in expected points added and all that. I'm also making a little bit of a ding at Mike McCarthy, right? I think Mike McCarthy, you know, kind of holds people back a little bit. So that's kind of where I like sort of look at that and I say, okay, I'm going to add this all up. I think highly of Dak, but not that highly. I think, you know, moderately of Mike McCarthy. And yet this team leads the league in scoring. Where does this come from? And I'm like, I think Kellen Moore deserves a little bit of credit.
It's interesting that you bring up Mike McCarthy. I was wondering about that the more that I kind of dug into all of your stuff for this interview, because your top five defensive play callers in order, Leslie Frazier of the Bills is one, followed by Dan Quinn of the Cowboys. Then, just for the listeners, Dennis Allen, now the head coach of the Saints, Raheem Morris, who I love, of the Rams, and Josh Boyer of the Dolphins was number five. But Dan Quinn, you have number two defense. You have Kellen Moore, number two offense. It seems like you think this team might be better if they just didn't have Mike McCarthy and maybe let their coordinators run more of the show or just had somebody else overseeing them. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Pro Football Reference's simple rating system now, I don't necessarily use it as the be-all, end-all, but they were the first. I mean, they outscored their opponents last year by 10 points a game. I mean, they were first in scoring, seventh in scoring defense. This is after season, and granted, all, you know, the offense was amazing last year when Dak played, but they were a team, you know, in a season where, like, Dak Prescott didn't play much. They were still 17th in scoring. They were 28th in scoring prior to Dan Quinn coming over last year. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think McCarthy's like the worst coach in football. I think he's probably a median coach, but you're getting fantastic outcomes with this team. You know, I think a lot of that goes on the coordinators. And to a certain degree, hiring good coordinators is part of being a great head coach. And they have John Fossil as special teams coordinator, Jim's son. So they do that, and I think that they're okay. But I think McCarthy's more of a middle-of-the-pack guy. And middle-of-the-pack head coaches without great assistants don't outscore their opponents by 10 points per game.
Two more for you. We're bringing this one home. Number one, take this absolutely anywhere you want to go. Can you give me one bold prediction for this upcoming NFL season that you think might surprise some people?
Yeah, so like, I mean, if you know, Detroit making the playoffs is one. I think that's like 4-1 now, depending upon where you look. That was
you have Detroit making the playoffs.
That has been my boldest call, 4-1. So 4-1, you need an implied probability of about 20. I make it 27. So I think that there's a decent edge there on Detroit. You just look at the NFC and who is it going to be? If it's not, you know. There's teams that disappoint you every single year. I think that there's two open spots there for any team, and that includes Washington to sort of come up and surprise people. I think another one I think the Chiefs passing game is going to be better this year without Tyreek Hill. I, as a Chiefs fan, I sort of watched that team for a long time. They've given me a lot of joy. Tyreek Hill has been a fabulous player, but I thought, you know, the league had sort of figured out how to cover them. And I'm ecstatic. As Washington fans know, Andy Reid's a genius at sort of zigging when the rest of the league is zagging. I'm excited now that he has, you know, a deeper group of receivers to work with. Not necessarily a great one, but a deeper group of receivers to work with. And I think that he'll make a lot out of that team. So I'm not necessarily going to bet the Chiefs like to go over their win total or whatever. I might bet them in the longer markets, like 10-1 to win the Super Bowl or you know, 7-2 to win the AFC. But I think it's going to come together for them. In a year where I think a lot of people, because of their schedules being difficult or losing Tyreek, I think a lot of people believe they're going to take a step back. I'm going to slow my roll on that a little bit. I think that they're going to be okay.
Last one, Eric. Let's forget about fall football. I want to talk a little spring football, the USFL Championship. Sunday, July 3rd, it is the Birmingham Stallions, last I checked, giving 4.5 points to the Philadelphia Stars. Any bets you like for that one?
Yeah, and the Stars, whether they be, I believe they were Philadelphia twice in the 80s, and then they were, I want to say, the Baltimore Stars the last year, but there have been four USFL title games in the history of the league, and the Stars have played in all four of them, which is kind of crazy. I'm the proud owner of a 7-1 Philadelphia Stars ticket to win it all. I'm going to be riding with them. I think that they're getting 4.5. It opened 3.5 in Circa Sports, which is one of the sharper books in the market. So, and I think it's 4.5 now. So, yeah, 4.5 minus 110. I'll go with that. If I had to bet on the total, I would take over, but I know that's gone up from 44 on the open to 46 now, so probably not as much value. Last week's Philadelphia Stars game, the total was 47.5, and there were, I think, each team had 2 red zone turnovers and a missed field goal in the red zone. So that game ended up being, I believe, 33 was the final total, even though the game played very much to the over. The Stars don't have a great defense, but they have a great offense, and the Stallions, I think, have been very inconsistent on offense. Very good on defense. So it'll be a matchup between those two teams.
Eric, where can listeners find you?
So I'm at PFF_Eric on Twitter. And I'm, you know, I have the PFF forecast, which is every Wednesday and every Sunday night on PFF's YouTube channel as well as iTunes. And then I also host a Kansas City Chiefs podcast called Red, Gold, and Bold, which is out every Tuesday. And an NFL podcast with the same Kansas City folks called Too Deep, which is out every Thursday.
Eric Eager, Pro Football Focus. I tell you, man, I always love when I get you PFF guys on the pod. I always feel like I learned so much. Thanks again for coming on. Awesome stuff. Maybe we can have you back once we hit the season here.
Thanks for having me on.
Joining me now, Ben Fox, Vice President of Digital Content for VSiN. Ben, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I got to say, man, I had a ton of people reach out wanting more info about what in the world happened with the NBA draft, betting markets, what in the world happened with the Woj bomb that wasn't. And I thought you did a great job laying it all out in a column on VSiN.com. Here's a quick summation, mostly pulling from your column. The number one overall market had pretty much been a two-horse race for a while between Jabari Smith and Chet Holmgren. At one point, Paolo Banchero was like 20-1. To go first overall. That had moved to roughly 7-1, 9-1 by the Monday before the draft. Lots of sharp bettors were hammering Paolo. Then Wednesday night, Paolo goes from about a plus 425 bet to the bet to be the favorite to go number one overall to about plus 135. Then comes Thursday morning, Woj tweets out the order's pretty much set. It's going to be Jabari, Chet, Paolo. The odds flip again, and sure enough, Woj ends up walking back his tweet that night. Paolo goes number one. Ben, I don't know that I can remember any other event where we've seen this kind of market movement and uncertainty. What in the world happened?
Yeah, this is kind of unprecedented, and you did a good job summarizing that. The only thing I'd add is that on late Wednesday night, and into Thursday morning, that was the first time that Paolo Banchero was actually the favorite and the odds-on favorite. He got up to minus 200 to go number one overall. And what's so interesting about that is that then on Thursday morning, after that Woj tweet, all the sports books took these odds down because Woj, I can't remember a time he's been wrong, kind of assuming that it was a fait accompli, that Jabari was going number one. And they put it back up. I think FanDuel had Jabari as minus 10,000 with Paolo Banchero at plus 900. And slowly over the course of the day, those odds came down minus 6,000, minus 3,000, minus 1,200. Got all the way down to minus 135 with Paolo, I think, at plus 100 before, again, Jabari money started coming in. And he was still the favorite until basically about 20 minutes before the draft, when Woj went on the ESPN pregame show and then shortly after that tweeted out that it looked like Paolo Banchero, was kind of in the mix now to be number one. And he sent out a couple of other tweets over the next few minutes that also changed the markets, just saying it increasingly was looking like Banchero was in the mix to all of a sudden, it looks like Banchero is going number one. And then about 10 minutes later, he did indeed go number one.
On the whole, it seems like sharp bettors were the ones who really benefited from this, right? In your column, you actually quote a couple guys that we've had on the podcast. Drew Dinsick did really well. Crack, I believe, as well.
Yeah. So in reporting this out, there kind of were, I think probably it's fair to say three or four, but probably three main buckets of bettors. I think there were the bettors like Drew, like Gil Alexander on VSiN, our network, who just thought the odds were out of whack. Right. So this opened in April and some books before that as really a three horse race. and Banchero was around plus 200, you know, 2-1, 3-1. He was the third option to go number one overall, but it wasn't that big of a spread between the other, you know, the other two guys. All of a sudden, then, you know, I think he hadn't worked out officially for Orlando and people read into that. Like you said, he was 15-1, 20-1. I think there were some bettors who just said there's a much better chance than 20-1 that he's going number one, or that the Rockets trade up with the Magic and they take him at number one. Just 20-1 is too big. And then I think also on that Sunday night, Monday morning, from talking to some bettors, talking to some bookmakers, as they like to say, somebody knew something. And there was some more informational betting of people who had good information that Paolo likely was going number one and were betting based off of that. That's kind of the second bucket. And then the third bucket is people seeing the odds shift and dramatically decrease, and Paolo going from 20-1 to 15 to 10 to 7, and then jumping on that train and saying, okay, if these odds are shifting this much, probably somebody knows that. And it all kind of came together, especially on that Monday morning. And then I think that Wednesday night, probably word was out a little more, the fact that maybe Paolo was going number one. But I think this story is so interesting because it completely shifted again on that Thursday morning after that Woj tweet.
Books had mixed results after this?
Yeah, these markets, the event-based markets, so by that I mean kind of the NFL draft, the NBA draft, they're very difficult for sports books to win. They kind of need to offer it because their competitors are offering it. And so if you want people to be betting at your book, it looks bad if you're not offering something that your competitor is. But basically, it's an information game, and the sports books, everyone's following Twitter and TweetDeck, and Woj and Schefter and beat reporters, but it's the other information, whether that's coming from other bettors, coming from inside the books, coming from bettors who have teams of people scouring the internet and mock drafts and, you know, press conferences and all this stuff. They have more information generally than the bookmakers. And so they're going to bet these, you know, odds at much higher odds, right? So it doesn't take a lot for liability to add up when you're betting Paolo Banchero at 10-1, you know, 15-1, 20-1. There was a DraftKings bettor who had him at $10,000 at 5-1. You know, all of a sudden that's $50,000 liability on Paolo when Jabari is the favorite. There's a lot that it takes to even out that action. So most sports books were, you know, small to moderate losers. I know WinBet, they were one that really, they said they got smoked. Interestingly, one was Twin Spires. They had 93% of the handle on Jabari Smith. They actually took it down on Wednesday night, thinking just Jabari's going number one, and they avoided all of the Paolo Banchero money. So they were one of the few that was really came out a winner. I'd say all in all, you know, it was most books were small losers, but they'll all be opening up tomorrow and the next day and the next day. So they'll be just fine.
I guess add all this up, and it's why some states don't even allow gambling on stuff like the NBA draft, right? And for instance, just for the listeners, I live in Maryland. Maryland doesn't have mobile betting set up yet. I typically drive right into Virginia. It's a 13-minute drive from my house to put in bets there. But in Virginia, you can't bet on the draft. You can't bet on the Oscars. Basically anything that people, you know, decide on themselves. It's not an athletic event. You can't bet on. So I bet in DC for this one, which is a whole nother story. But I guess what we're talking about is kind of why some states do it the way they do.
For sure. And the rules are different in different states, which also complicates it further and makes it more difficult for books. So here in Nevada, 24 hours before any of these events, the odds have to be down. So NFL draft, NBA draft, you know, the NFL draft was here in Vegas this year. People who came to see the draft could not bet on the draft. There are no odds available because they all had to be down 24 hours beforehand. Whereas other states, you can actually have live betting during the draft, leading up to the draft. I don't think the odds were taken down at some books until, you know, a couple minutes before that number one pick, before 8 p.m. Eastern on Thursday was made. So it just depends on the state. Right now, that's kind of a weird thing. We'll see if that gets buttoned up or there's more standardized regulations. But like so many things in sports betting, the U.S. right now is kind of a state-by-state basis.
in states that do allow betting on the NBA draft and other events like it, is there anything that we can learn as bettors from this to take away from this, or does it tell us anything about, you know, betting drafts in the future?
It's a good question. I think the number one thing is just you always want to reference, kind of have the reference, the odds in the back of your mind and just see what's going on with them. Just as a kind of a data point, right? What do they open at? Maybe check in a couple weeks later, depending on when you're thinking about betting this. And I think the biggest thing, so one is kind of follow the market. And two is just that, you know, Schefter and Woj and all these people are not infallible, right? They are exceptionally good at their job. And like I said, I have, you know, done a couple podcasts and been talking to people. I legitimately don't remember another time that Woj has been wrong. And so I think that's also the thing to remember. A lot of bettors jumped, and a lot of books I spoke to, public bettors jumped on Jabari Smith Jr. to go number one on Thursday morning, thinking that, okay, once the Woj tweet was out, no matter what number it was at, even if it was minus, you know, 6,000, minus 3,000, it's the equivalent of free money, which, as we know, there's no such thing as free money. I think that's especially the case, is don't make a bet just based on one of those tweets, because it doesn't mean that's 100% correct. So if you do see something and then a couple reporters verify it, it's more than likely to be correct. But especially in this case, right, Shams didn't have it. Woj was wrong. There was, you know, as far as I know, nobody who kind of had this from the start. The Magic front office was very tight-lipped. It's just something to consider all variables and just, you know, don't stake your entire bankroll just on one tweet, basically, is what I would say.
Very good advice. Very good advice. I mentioned earlier that I can't remember any other instance where betting markets swung this wildly and so many times. Can you remember any other time that something like this has happened?
So the biggest one, I mean, we had it a little bit with this NFL draft with Trayvon Walker going number one and the odds switch, but they didn't switch back. That was the biggest thing, right? Once they flipped and Trayvon Walker was the favorite to go number one, that was it. And kind of you were on either side, depending on who you thought was going to go number one. There has been some of this in previous presidential elections, which, of course, you cannot bet on in the U.S., I think, for very good reason. But seeing that over overseas in England and some of those other markets, we've seen some things like that. And obviously that's, you know, information based as well. But that's kind of the closest comp that I can think of. Certainly something usually isn't where it sways one way and then swings back again the other way. So it's just kind of a crazy market. And like I was telling people, I was following this and thinking, hey, this could be an interesting story. And it's kind of bettors against Woj and who has the information and all this. But I didn't actually think it would happen that Paolo would go number one. And so I kind of had some base reporting done before the draft and then had to scramble into full reporter mode after it actually happened and kind of try and gain as much knowledge over how this happened and, like you said, what it means going forward.
Yeah, you did a great job with it, man. Like I told you, here, this feels like a good way to end this conversation. I'm actually just pulling this off of your Twitter feed, and it's from a few days ago, so the odds may have changed a little bit. DK odds for 2022-23 NBA Rookie of the Year. Paolo, the favorite, 3-1. Jabari, plus 350. Chet, plus 475. Jaden Ivey, 5-1. Keegan Murray, 8-1. And then you got a mishmash of other guys. Mathurin, Sharp, 12-1. Dyson Daniels, 15-1. You like anybody there, Ben?
I have to say, I have no clue right now. And then those betting apps so far out, you're really going to try and project where they are in their rotations and who's going to get the most playing time. So some of that's going to be, is the team bad? And some of that's going to be, could there be an injury? You know, I think Keegan Murray is interesting, especially when you have kind of a potentially a bad team with Sacramento. But I think you're really looking for who's also going to play up tempo, right? Especially in today's NBA, take threes and essentially put up stats, because unlike the MVP or another market, it isn't necessarily correlated with winning, right? You could have a rookie of the year who's on a bad team and averages 25 points a game. They're more looking at individual stats. So in short, I'd say no. I'm paid to report on the markets, not give the give the bets for good reason. But it's gonna be fascinating to play out, and I think those guys again, kind of like you had the Markelle Fultz, Jason Tatum. You know, you'll have Paolo and you'll have Jabari Smith and Chet Holmgren kind of connected for their whole careers now, depending on how it plays out.
It's going to be a fun one to watch. Ben, where can listeners find you?
Yeah, all my work's at VSiN.com, and you can follow us on at VSiN Live, VSIN. And then I'm at BFox22 on Twitter. So that's where all the good stuff is.
Ben Fox, VSiN, great work on this one. Great reporting on this one. And thanks again for coming on.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Ladies and gents, I'm excited for this one. Fred Siegel of the incredible Freezing Cold Takes Twitter feed and an upcoming Freezing Cold Takes book is back. What's happening, Fred?
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is great. So before we get into your top three all-time NBA free agency Freezing Cold Takes, I will mention you recently got a little bit of love kind of from Kevin Durant, who used one of your tweets to call out Colin Cowherd for saying that KD wasn't worth a top pick back when he was drafted because he couldn't bench press 185 pounds at the combine. That must have been pretty cool.
Well, I don't know if he actually really paid attention to my account, but he used the tweet to make fun of him.
He retweeted you.
Mentioned my account, but yeah, that's cool. It's always gets good recognition on the account.
Yeah, man. I mean,
he's showing it. Yeah, yeah.
He quote tweeted you, so he must have seen
it. Yeah, he quote tweeted. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know if he understands like what the account is, but
well, yeah. You know, I'm sure you got a little traction because of it. Nonetheless. Oh yeah, I thought it was cool.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, it's always good when that happens.
All right. Can't wait to hear these freezing cold takes, Fred. We're going with your three favorite takes dealing with NBA free agency, which I know is kind of like a concept. So, you know, however these deal with free agency, that's just fine with me. It starts this week. That's why we're doing it. But I want your top three NBA free agency freezing cold takes. Here we go, Fred. Take it away. Let's start with number three. What is number three, your third favorite?
Okay, number three. Well, this is a coaching change, but it came right after the season ended. So, and coaching changes are similar to free agency.
Like, sure.
Yeah, so when Phil Jackson left Chicago after 98 season, he went to LA for the 99-2000 season. He may have taken a season off, but he went to LA and Skip Bayless was writing for the Chicago Sun-Times. And he wrote that they're going to find out that Phil Jackson's a fraud and he's nothing without Michael Jordan.
Didn't age well.
You're not getting the same guy. And Phil Jackson essentially did the same thing.
Definitely a cold take there. Let's move on to your second favorite NBA free agency freezing cold take of all time. Go for it, Fred.
Okay. So this one is from 2011. It was right after, I think the Heat had lost in the finals with their big three. The first time they had the big three.
To the Mavericks.
Free agency. Like that was all free. Like to the Mavericks. And of course the big thing before that season was LeBron signed as a free agent to the Heat. And there were many people trashing the big three. And but the funny one was someone from the Chicago Sun-Times. I think his name is Dan Cahill. He wrote that, you know, at second thought, it's a lot better LeBron James didn't join the Bulls. Because, you know, LeBron at the time of the free agency was like considering the Bulls. The Bulls were one of the big teams. He was considering the Bulls and Knicks. You know, staying in Cleveland and Miami were probably the three, four, like that was the, you know, what he was going to do. And so then he said that at the end, he wrote, I'd much prefer to deal with Carlos Boozer and his baggage than LeBron's.
Yeah, that's a freezing cold take for sure. I remember the 2011 finals well because I was in Vegas at the time on vacation and I lost a bunch of money betting on the Heat. Fred, your number one all-time NBA free agency freezing cold take is?
Well, this one has to do with Kevin Durant. And the take was made in 2017, February. But it's in regard to the summer in which the summer of 2016 on July 4th, when Durant said he was going to go to announce when he signed with the Warriors that summer. And Nick Wright, he had a lot of comments like this, but I boil it down to one in February. They were kind of struggling, the Warriors. They weren't the same as they were. They weren't playing like they were the year before. The year before they won 73 games. Of course, they lost in the finals. But you know, Durant was hurt a lot of the time, and you know, they weren't playing as well. They were holding on to the number one seed in the West. And Nick Wright said, if the Warriors had to do it over again, they wouldn't have gotten Durant. They wouldn't have signed. Facts bear that out. and he banged this drum a lot from February till like May or June before they like dominated that finals.
Right, right.
So yeah, so that's what I would say is number one.
Yeah, it's a pretty good one. Couple of championships later, definitely a freezing cold take for sure. Plug away. Twitter feed, the book, go to town.
Oh, well, yeah, follow me at Old Takes Exposed, at Old Takes Exposed on Twitter and Freezing Cold Takes on Instagram. And in a month, just over a month, there's my first book's coming out, Freezing Cold Takes NFL, which is basically an encyclopedia of inaccurate predictions and commentary from about players and teams from NFL history and past and present. And it's in like narrative form, a lot of the chapters about specific situations in the past, like specific teams. And there's also a chapter on the draft where I just list like a plethora of old quotes and tweets about the draft when they happened, like during the draft, that are just completely hilarious now. So it's a good book. It took me a long time. It was a lot of research. So, yeah, check that out. It's called Freezing Cold Takes NFL, and it's available for pre-order. And if you look at my pinned tweet on my Twitter feed, there's all the details right there.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks again for coming on, Fred. Fred Siegel, Freezing Cold Takes. Everybody buy the book. Thanks for coming back, man. This is great.
Thank you.
There you have it, ladies and gents. Thanks to Eric, Ben, and Fred. Really enjoyed talking to all three of those guys. Have some good stuff coming here these next few weeks. It's kind of a dead period sports-wise, but I like what we've got coming. So thanks for listening. And yeah, as always, any feedback, you know where to find me. Thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing IG at Rambling and Gambling, and the old email, ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. Everybody, have a great week.